It gives me great pleasure to welcome Stephen to give his concurrent session. I should say plenary because it's such an important topic and relevant topic. The topic is on harnessing the Big Bang from digital disruption to digital transformation. Firstly, about Stephen. Stephen is a partner at Deloitte based in Melbourne within the consulting practice. He's had over 20 years of experience in financial services covering life insurance, wealth management, and superannuation. He consults to a number of the large industry funds on matters not just actuarial, but also strategic, operational, and more complex problems beyond that. He's talked in a number of forums about social media, digital disruption, and I'm sure this will be an interesting and informative presentation. With that, I'll hand over to Stephen.
Thanks, Sam. And as we begin, I guess given we're talking about digital disruption, I'm more than happy for people to tweet during the session. Say whatever you feel like you need to say. I guess as I was preparing this and thinking about, as actuaries, is it important? What do we need to know? And thinking about our role, actuaries working for either our employers or our clients, is about trying to make sense of uncertainty, financial risks, things like that. And I think probably one of the biggest uncertainties facing the financial services industry today is the digital disruption, the uncertainty coming from the new technology. So as actuaries, as advisors, or as employees, senior employees of organisations like banks, insurance companies and superannuation funds, we need to know what's going on. We need to help our organisations adapt and thrive through the disruption. And as actuaries, we know that predicting the future is very difficult. There's a lot of quotes like this that many of you will have come across previously. And I think it just highlights the difficulty that we have trying to make sense of the future, either as actuaries looking at the financial risks or in technology trying to predict where the next big trend will come from. But that shouldn't stop us trying to look ahead, trying to sense what's coming, and trying to help our organisations be prepared for what they might or might not know is happening. And I think one of the big changes is the fact that we've got so much power now in our hand. And that's really changing the way our customers deal with us. Many of the previous big technological changes have changed the way organisations have dealt internally, become more efficient. When I started as an actuary in a life insurance company, there was rows and rows of actuaries doing calculations, term alterations and surrender values. We don't see that anymore. But it was a very much inward change. Now the changes we're seeing being driven by digital disruption are very much affecting the consumer and very much driven by the smartphone and the tablet. And the pace of change is increasing exponentially. There's a lot of charts around the take-up of mobile technology, the adoption of some of the social media platforms. This one's looking at Moore's Law. Most of you will have come across Moore's Law about just the increasing power of the transistor. And in fact, this year, we're celebrating 50 years of the Moore's Law. So what does that mean for our technologies? And the term exponential is one that we're hearing more and more when people are talking about the digital disruption. And the term exponential technologies. And this slide has a few. Many of you will have heard of some of these. Some of them are still at the edge. Some of them are more almost gimmicky. Whether they'll actually impact businesses or not in the future, we're not quite sure yet. But we're certainly seeing an enormous take-up. Just think about drones, for example. It wasn't that long ago that it was something that the military used in battle. Now, many people I know have got their own drones and fly them around on the weekends, use them for a bit of fun, taking photos. Many organisations now are looking at using drones for their businesses and experimenting with delivering. Or insurance companies using it as an insurance assessment tool, flying into the disaster zones. There's all sorts of different ways drones are being adapted. Similarly with any of those technologies there. Now, in the short space of time we've got together, I'm not going to be able to go into a lot of detail of all of these. But what I want to do is just talk about some of them and how it more particularly impacts us working in financial services. Things like mobile wallets, payments is one of the big disruptors that many people are working on. We hear about Apple Pay, Google Wallet, and how that's going to adopt, change the way we work. Crowd-based, funds, sharing economy, automation, artificial intelligence, algorithms. So I'll talk through some of these during the short time we've got together, but really it's giving you, hopefully, not just not the answers, but at least the curiosity to go away and learn a bit more. And starting with artificial intelligence, cognitive computing, the robots are coming, as we see in some of the headlines. And artificial intelligence, cognitive computing, and robots, which is a little bit different again, are changing the way we do things. I was listening to a podcast this morning where there's a chain in the US where each table has a tablet on it, where people can place their orders, pay their bills, and then talk about, you know, help them choose what to have for dinner. So we're seeing it very pervasive in our lives. One of the big areas where we're seeing a real rise in artificial intelligence is in what is loosely called robo-advice. Now that's a term that I don't particularly like, but it's one that's been adopted. When we do our shopping online or book our flights or hotels online, we don't talk about a robo-supermarket or robo-travel agent, but robo-advice is the term that seems to be used for these. And it has a bit of a connotation of robocop. So there's a bit of a violent, aggressive language associated to it. And robo-advisors really just automated wealth management platforms that are trying to use artificial intelligence, using algorithms, to do some or parts of the financial advice value chain. And it's interesting to see some of the headlines around robo-advice and the different ways people look at it. Is it a threat? Is it something that we can work with? Is it going to replace financial advice? Or maybe even work together with financial advisors? And if you go on the internet, you'll find enormous numbers of them. The two big ones in the United States, Betterment and Wealthfront, are both attracting a lot of money from venture capital. You stick fintech in front of your startup and you'll have lots of people knocking on your door to give you cash. But they're also starting to attract some assets from investors. Such to the extent that we're seeing people like Vanguard and Charles Schwab, two of the largest fund managers, setting up their own robo-advice offerings to try and combat it. Here in Australia, there are a number around Brightday, Stockspot, and a few others I know that are in sort of development stage at the moment. And if you think about financial advice, yes, there are times we need to go to an advisor, we need comprehensive advice, we need to think about a whole range of variables. But for many people, it's a much simpler approach. You know, I'm at a certain age, I'm approaching retirement, you know, here's my risk profile, what should I be thinking about? And with so many people approaching retirement and such limited numbers of financial advisors, we do need other ways of trying to fulfil the needs. And so-called robo-advisors are definitely one of those. The other thing when you look at robo-advisors, and what really sticks in my mind when I see have a look at their websites, is it's all about the interface. And I think it's a really important thing to think about when you're looking at any sort of fintech startups, any sort of digital disruption in financial services. You'll see that the ones that are being successful, the ones that are trying to do things differently, are really focusing on the customer interface. It's not about pushing product, it's not about pushing advisors, it's about making it easy for the consumer to do what they need to do when they want to do it. Have a think about how many of you now do your banking on your phone or your tablet, as opposed to even visiting your bank's website. While you're on the tram, sitting and watching TV in the evening, it's about the convenience to do it when you want, how you want to do it. And we're seeing that same type of approach being adopted with these robo-advisors. And robots are coming into all sorts of different areas. This bank in Japan is experimenting a bit with having robots in the bank, and part of the reason is they're looking ahead to 2020, the Olympics, and the multilingual aspect of it. So they're looking at having robots that are multilingual be able to service customers during the Olympics in 2020.
What if there were only one kind of dog? Then it would be easy to know everything about that one breed. But in fact, there are over 300 breeds of dogs. Because no one can be an expert in every one, an app powered by IBM Watson will help vets tap specialized knowledge in the cloud for every breed and whatever else walks, flies, or slithers through the door. IBM Watson is working to make medicine smarter every day.
So have a think about that little video. It's IBM have called their vet product LifeLearn Sophie, and it's being built on IBM Watson. Hands up, have you heard of IBM Watson? Quite a few. It actually became quite well known about 4 years ago when it won Jeopardy, the TV show on where you actually they ask the contestants a question, the answer, and you've got to give the question. And so it's quite a complex game, and it was quite amazing that IBM Watson was able to win Jeopardy. And if you read the stuff coming out of IBM about it, it was done very much as a bit of a PR stunt to try and raise the profile of their product. And they've got a whole business line put together to try and find business applications for IBM Watson. And this vets application is one of them. And if you think about the message behind it, what it was actually, how it was positioning itself. All dogs are different. There's so much to learn. How can one vet be able to keep on top of all that? So here we're having artificial intelligence not taking over, but as a tool to help the professional. And so have a look. Whenever you see artificial intelligence and robots being talked about, you'll find sometimes it's about replacing. And we're certainly seeing that on production lines, and that's no different than it's been for many generations in factories. But in the service or professional services or other areas, often we're seeing it as a bit of an adjunct to help us. And when we're making decisions, we're human. We aren't always making great decisions, depending on our emotional state at the time. So maybe it would be great to have a robot like IBM or artificial intelligence like IBM Watson to help us avoid some of those cognitive biases that mere humans are subject to. There's been an interesting study on that that sort of area done in Israel, looking at a parole board. And apparently, depending on how close you are to the start of the day or lunch, it actually makes an impact on how favourable hearing you'll get at your parole board. The earlier in the day, the more favourable hearing you'll get. And as it gets closer to lunch, it's the less favourable. So there's a lot of areas where we are human. And even if we know we've got these cognitive biases, it's very hard to actually avoid them. So using artificial intelligence, cognitive computing, in areas like maybe investments and things like that, can help us overcome some of that. IBM have also done work in the legal profession. So they've called it ROS. And the purpose of ROS is to help with the complex things of looking at precedents, managing case studies, looking up complicated law. So again, helping the attorney, and not just look it up historically, but also monitor what's going on, so if there's any additional case history or any additional legislation that the particular attorney needs to know about, it'll update them and avoid that. You know, one of the hardest parts of law is keeping up to date with so much legislation. And if you look at some of the legislation that we as actuaries need to deal with, anything that helps us do that better will be really well accepted. So we've seen IBM Watson as a vet, as a super intelligent attorney. How long till we have a super intelligent actuary as IBM Watson helping us? Or replacing us, who knows? The Internet of Things, the next thing I want to talk about. And the Internet of Things is something that we're seeing more and more talked about in recent times. And it's really just the idea that things are being connected. So it's not just internet connecting computers to computers, or computers to smartphones to tablets. All sorts of objects are being connected through the internet. You can buy light globes with wireless sensors in them, so you can control your dimmer and turn the lights on and off from your smartphone. Thermostats will learn about what you're doing and connect. And in fact, Google recently bought one of the companies that makes those thermostats, Nest. And many people are adopting activity trackers, fitness trackers. Now, hands up anybody here with a fitness tracker on at the moment? So you're all part of the Internet of Things. So how is that going to impact financial services and what we do as actuaries? Well, let's start with wearables. As we saw, there's quite a number of people here with one on at the moment. And there are a number of insurance companies, both here and around the world, that are linking an insurance policy with having one of these fitness bands on. Now, life insurance and health insurers are both doing this. Some of the rewards are more reward-based as opposed to premium, so you might get discounts at a gym or things like that. But some of the organisations, some of the life companies are actually linking it to premium discounts, knowing how much exercise you're going to have, things like that. In fact, I wasn't at the Barry Race session, but I was talking at lunchtime with a couple of people who were, and apparently the amount of activity you're doing during the day is a better indicator of mortality than things like BMI. So how do you measure how much activity people do a day? Check their fitness bands. Now, it creates some interesting challenges for the organisations. As I was preparing for this and talking about that with my wife, she just said, oh, well, all I'll do is put the fitness band around the dog. So yes, there are going to be some challenges. And I think what's important as you're thinking about some of these disruptions, realising that some of them will have disappeared in a year or two. They won't be, you know, the next thing, you know, best things in sliced bread. They're not going to solve all the problems. But somewhere among them will be ideas and things that will change the organisations we work with and work for. So fitness bands. There's actually, one of the previous sessions also, somebody was talking about some underwriting and the way underwriting's done, and looking at one of the South African life insurance companies. And that also, they actually pioneered a lot of that using the fitness bands, and it's AIA in Australia's doing it, John Hancock in the US, and I think Prudential in the UK, just some of the major companies, but a lot of smaller insurance companies are using it. And again, similarly, health insurance. But even outside of that direct link between fitness and insurance, there's a bank in Russia that has a special savings account that if you do your 10,000 steps in a day, they'll transfer a small amount of money from your standard account into your higher interest-bearing account. And that's the only way you can access the higher interest-bearing account is through your fitness band. And what that's doing is combining sort of preferences. You know, people want to get fit and people want to save. So here's a way of attracting people to our bank by appealing to both of those needs that we have to try and get fit and try and save. So wearables, sensors, Internet of Things, very important from a personal insurance point of view. I guess even a bigger impact is in auto insurance. And the term that gets used here is telematics. And telematics has been around quite a long time. And originally it was quite clunky black boxes and not a huge take-up. Now telematics devices, as you can see from the picture, are small little things that will slot into your car or even be an app on your car. Many, many newer cars now have their own app stores and you can download apps onto your car. And so it gives rise to the usage-based insurance in a very strong way. Now, there's still quite a bit of resistance from people, and there's that balance between how much you want to give up in terms of privacy. And for many of us, the thought of giving up that sort of privacy and that sort of data is something that we'd find quite difficult. But generations certainly following me, and if I look at my daughters in their 20s, people are much more willing to share. Look at what people share on Facebook and other parts of social media. So that sort of wanting to hold on to your privacy and hold on to your own personal data is very different for different generations. So things like the fitness bands and the telematics in your car will have a different appeal to Gen Ys, Millennials, Gen Zs, whatever you want to call them. Here in Melbourne, and I'm assuming in Sydney as well, we're seeing a lot of the AAMI ads, where these two obnoxious guys are competing on their apps for safe driving. Similar sort of approach. There, it's not just using the telematic type approach, but it's also appealing to gamification. The fact we want to compete against our friends. So again, the gamification overcomes that desire to keep private that data. So we're happy to share that data if it means we can outdo our mates and have boasting rights down at the pub. So think about the data that's been collected by AAMI through those things. What are they going to do with all that data? We'll see. So some of it can be used for premium setting. Some of it will be used for marketing and targeting individuals in a much more personalised way. So things like the fitness bands, the telematics devices, it's not just about usage-based premiums. It's also about marketing and about getting to know you as an individual. And again, that's another big trend that digital disruption is bringing to us. Think about when you go onto Amazon now. It'll recommend books for you. People like you, will buy, like these books. And we're getting more and more used to that personal approach. So if we've got an organisation that's not using all the data they can to help, give me a better experience, the millennials, the Gen Ys are going to look somewhere else for someone who can give them that experience. Because the expectations aren't being set by other financial service institutions. Expectations are being set by people like Google and Amazon and Uber and Airbnb. And the telematics devices are just part of that collection of data and the personalisation of experiences. And the home is also being connected. So the picture on the right here, Habitat is a Italian insurance company that have, Habitat is the name of their policy, and you get with it sensors, that control box, plus a whole lot of other wireless sensors that you put around the house, and it gets connected to their control room. So it monitors your temperature, lights, the whole bit, but also will know if you've had robberies, fires, etc., and linking that to back to their offices. So again, it's all part of trying to enhance the experience for the user. Is that really going to make a big difference for house insurance? Will people really differentiate because they can get all those sensors? Not sure yet. But it's innovation won't always work first time. But it's about trying to use the technology to do something different. And again, Nest, which is now owned by Google, that have smart thermostats, are also partnering up with various insurance companies as well. So we're finding all sorts of interesting coalitions being formed by different organisations looking at trying to come up with a different way of connecting with the consumer. The sharing economy is one that's been talked about a bit, and the sharing economy is everything from Airbnb and Uber right through to crowdfunding and crowdsourcing. Has anybody here taken part in any sort of crowdfunding on something like Kickstarter or something like that? A few people, okay. So I've done a few where, musicians, I'm very much into music and always looking for new music to listen to, and if I, hear some music that's interesting, the musicians got it on Kickstarter to try and raise the money to press and issue the CD, and I'm more than happy to, if I like the music, to sign up. And the way it works is that you pledge a certain amount, but it doesn't get taken until they reach a certain limit and actually make the product. So if they don't reach that limit, you haven't lost any money. And depending on how much you want to get, you can put in $10 and you'll be able to download a file. If you put in $15, for example, you'll get sent a CD. You put in $1,000, they'll come and play it in your lounge room for you. And they do that. So T-shirts, that's at the low level. But there have been some Kickstarter projects where they've raised millions. And now we're seeing the same approach being used in private equity. There's a company in Australia called Equitize, which is looking at doing private equity in a similar sort of approach. Now, there needs to be a few change tweaks to some of the legislation, but there's some discussion papers around, and we expect we'll see that. So, using the crowd for all sorts of things. I mean, I use the crowd a lot when I, you know, want answers to questions. I'll use Twitter. And suddenly I've got 2,500 people that will hopefully see my question, and maybe even more people once they retweet it. So the sharing economy has a big impact on all economic entities, but I think in insurance and banking, it's going to have a big impact. Peer-to-peer insurance is probably the most obvious area where, as actuaries, will certainly be impacted. And there's different types of peer-to-peer insurance. Guevera is a UK product. And they pull premiums online, and any money left will be distributed, will be used to offset premiums in the following year. And sometimes they're a bit hard to work out exactly how they're doing these things. It's very much customer focused, but you've got to read carefully and look at the sort of various the way they describe their approaches to get a real understanding of the actual approach this particular peer-to-peer insurance is doing. So it's important to know that all peer-to-peer insurance isn't the same. There are quite a few different models around. Peer cover was just recently in New Zealand, just recently launched in New Zealand. And their approach is, and if you read the stuff, to share the cost of the excess. And you're able actually then, you know, if you can find the right pool to share the excess with, you can sort of take a higher excess with your insurer and therefore reduce the premiums, is the theory behind what they're doing. Metro Mile, I guess the name's sort of a giveaway, pay per mile insurance. They'll have using a telematics device in the car, it'll monitor your mileage and your insurance will be based on how much you drive. And Metro Mile have actually done a deal with Uber, and provide insurance to the Uber drivers, sort of pay per mile approach. And this one's an interesting one. Sort of a cooperative type arrangement. And I guess one of the things, so you go online, and if you want to insure your dog or your house or something quite obscure, maybe Wayne might want to insure his elbow. And you can find a group of people who want to insure the same thing. And you join their group, and then as a group buys that insurance and can source lower premiums, in theory. So if we think about peer-to-peer insurance, it's actually not new. The basic concepts of peer-to-peer insurance are actually going right back to the origin of insurance 250 years ago, where people sat around the coffee shops in London or the shipyards of Venice and agreed to support each other and help each other out if their ship got lost, or, you know, people sat around and said, okay, if somebody dies, we'll support their widow and you get the widow's pension. So the type of approach being adopted here is not that different from the origins of insurance before the big insurance companies got in the way and sort of separated the various people involved. And the key that's bringing it all back together is the mobile technology. It's not just the internet, it's actually more. It's the fact that it can be on your mobile. So it's the convenience of it. And if you think about Uber for a minute, what they're doing is not really that new. When I was at university in the late 70s, early 80s, we shared rides from Monash University down North Road. And there was a spot you could go and you could meet, as a hitching post, or there was a bulletin board you could write your name. And you pitched in and shared the petrol costs. That's really what Uber is, I guess. But the difference is, it's the interface. It's a really cool interface on your iPhone. It's frictionless. You don't need to worry about paying. It's all done as part of the app. So it's the mobile technology which is really changing things. And it's making it all about the customer. And I think that's a really important thing. It's very easy to be sort of wowed by the shiny objects and all these wonderful technologies, the flying cars and the jetpacks. But really, the digital disruption, it's all about disrupting the relationship between the consumer and the entity. And it's putting the power right into the consumer and really genuinely making the consumer at the centre. And that's what these are all trying to do. Similarly, if you look at the peer-to-peer lending that's around. So, again, avoiding the banks, connecting lenders and borrowers. And there's a number of organisations around. You Google peer-to-peer lending and you'll get all sorts in both Australia and overseas. But the key is about this ease of use and the connecting. I guess I couldn't not talk about big data and analytics, being at an actuaries summit. It's a subject dear to all of our hearts. And big data, like a lot of these, becomes a bit of a buzzword and gets very overused. And analytics and seeing what's going on. But I think there are aspects of it. And I think the connection is that the sharing economy, the Internet of Things, it's producing enormous amounts of data. And one of the other beauties of having everything on your mobile is that the companies are collecting all that data from you. Because you're doing it online. If you're filling in forms and going into branches, it's much harder to collect that information and actually analyse that information. If you're doing it online, if you're doing it digitally, it's much easier to collect that rich data and then use that data. And insurance is one area where, and I'm sure many of you are working in insurance and don't need me to sort of give you all the ins and outs of how you can use big data in insurance. And every aspect, whether it's around claims and underwriting, whether it's our marketing. You know, we hear terms like segment of one and the personalisation of the experience. And it's all based on big data. And I guess the other part of big data, which is probably more interesting for actuaries, is the whole predictive elements of it. What can we do with that data to help us see the future better? Because that's very much the role of the actuary.
Up to this point, insurance has been a reactive model, protecting you and your possessions after an incident. That's all about to change with Presurance from Esurance, a state-of-the-art tool that will alert you before your next fender bender so you can avoid it. Finally, people will stop wondering and start knowing up to 7 days in advance.
You have a Presurance alert. Your next fender bender will occur in 6 days, 5 hours, and 12 minutes.
Presurance is more than just an algorithm. By analyzing U.S. driving data and statistics, we created a heuristic framework that kickstarted the development process. The end result is a precognitive predictive model based on factors like cyclones or the migration patterns of flightless birds.
Just something nice.
Your next fender bender will occur in 4 hours and 1 minute.
I'm sorry, I gotta take off. I just got a Presurance alert.
You'll have the power to know exactly when you'll get tapped by that delivery truck or bumped by a soccer mom's minivan. You'll even have the option to add it to your mobile calendar with just a tap so you can avoid it.
Honey, do you think you could pick up the kids from school today?
Yeah, I got a Presurance alert.
I'll admit, I thought it was too good to be true until I got my first Presurance alert. And then when that big truck smacked into me, I wasn't caught off guard at all. Thank you, Presurance.
Esurance is all about doing things in a more modern way. With Presurance, the future will literally be in the palm of your hand. Presurance is not a real product, and anything claiming to predict the future is a dirty liar. Presurance is not available in any state, even an agitated one. Never touch Presurance. If you think babies are cute, avoid Presurance at all costs. If your Presurance experience lasts more than 4 hours, consult a doctor. Presurance isn't recommended for premature adolescents and teens. Do not use Presurance near an open flame. Never stare directly at Presurance. Its vision is based on movement. Do not look in the mirror and say Presurance 3 times. Presurance, Presurance, Presurance.
So,
four Presurance alerts.
Esurance is a real company, but Presurance isn't a real product. It was released on April Fool's Day this year. But I love, and I've seen it a number of times, and I've presented it many times, but it's a lot of fun, but it also actually got a lot in it to think about. Because isn't that what we're trying to do? We're trying to collect more data, and we're trying to better predict the risk profile of our customers. So, the other thing at the end there, you saw I don't know, some of you might have caught the hashtag sorter, and e-assurance is really focusing on, rather than buying insurance that sort of meets my needs, again, it's trying to know more and more about their customers to better match the product, the premiums, with the individual needs of their members, of their policyholders. So, yeah, a bit of fun, but there's actually a lot in it if you think about it. And the whole idea of having it all in the palm of your hand and being able to help their customers. And it's worth having a look at some of their other videos. They're quite amusing, but again, focusing on that hashtag sorter. That it's not about finding insurance that's sort of okay for you. And that's a really important message. And I'll finish off by talking about social media a little bit. For those that do know me, and there's quite a few here, they know I spend too much time on social media. But there's a couple of different ways that actuaries can use social media. And the obvious one is connecting and sharing and learning. I had a great example recently. Some of you that work in pensions, superannuation, might be familiar with Reddington, which is a UK pension consultancy that focuses on the investment side. And I've got to know the two founders of Reddington on social media through Twitter, and we chat a bit about what's happening in the UK versus what's happening in Australia. And many of you will know that the UK looks like they're trying to adopt the worst of Australia's superannuation system by removing compulsory annuitisation. There's even talk you'll be able to actually sell your annuity that you've already got, because they feel that, it would be a disadvantage to those that have bought annuities before the compulsory annuitisation was lifted. So I was having an interesting Twitter conversation with Rob, one of the founders of Reddington, and he was preparing to do a presentation on this, on what's happening in the UK, and wanted to know a bit more about what's happening in Australia. And then we hopped onto Skype, because we couldn't have, 140 characters limits what you can do. So we hopped onto Skype and we had a really good conversation. We've agreed that we'll catch up on Skype every 6 to 8 weeks and just talk about what's going on in Australia versus the UK. And that came out of an interaction that started on social media and on Twitter. So that's one area. But I think for us as actuaries advising our clients, there's a more important aspect of it, is the whole use of social media for business. So many businesses now are using social media for customer relations, for customer servicing. And there are people that, rather than ringing up a helpline, will jump straight onto Twitter and tweet something. And it's getting terrific responses. But also in underwriting and claims management. We've done some experiments with clients about scraping social media sites to help inform the underwriting process. There's an interesting story that I came across of a woman in the US that put a claim in for her car, had been written off in a car accident, etc., etc. But before the insurance company paid the claim, they checked the woman's social media and found on Facebook she was talking about how her daughter had smashed her car. So the claim was denied and she was charged with fraud. So there's all sorts of different ways social media is being used by insurance companies, but also by investment managers and wealth management businesses. Because again, it's about the crowd, what people are talking about. And so for those of you who aren't sure what social media is, I find that explanation quite a useful one. So what are actuaries saying on Twitter? There's quite a few actuaries, and there's a few I can see in the room here that I have quite a few interactions is on Twitter. And for those of you who want to find out, you can subscribe to a couple of lists that I have, and you'll be able to follow what actuaries are doing on Twitter. And there's been quite a bit of conversation around the various sessions here today, and it's a different way of attending a conference. You can actually interact a little bit and adds another dimension. But that's sort of the social fun side of social media. Not going. Next. If I turn it off accidentally. Technology. Next slide. Stuck, is it? Apologies. Technology. Digital disruption. I've been disrupted by the digital technology. It's interesting, the term disruption. When I was talking to somebody about doing these, they were thinking, well, disruption, that's a bad thing. And for generations, disruption's been something we wanted to try to avoid. But it's interesting that disruption's actually been now seen more as a positive. And people are trying to disrupt. And in fact, at Deloitte, one of our in terms of putting together our strategy, to be disruptors is something that we want to try and be. And so disruption's taking a really interesting change of lens from being something to avoid and something negative to something that we want to try and do to others or do to the industry we're working in. So can actuaries be disruptors? Talking about social media, and one on the slide here is going all funny. A couple of other uses of social media in investments. So Self Wealth is an Australian business that uses crowdsourcing and social media to allow people to find portfolios they might want to invest in, see what other investors are doing. And just amateur investors, not necessarily professional investors. And there's quite a lot of those sites in the US. The other one is social media, using social media sentiment and predictive analytics to try and work out companies to invest in and what's happening. So social media is being used in all sorts of other areas, not just for communicating and letting people know what you have for breakfast. But social media can have quite a negative impact on the markets, and we need to be aware of the ups and the downs of social media. Some of you may have heard about this. A couple of years ago, the AP official website was hacked, and somebody sent that tweet out from Associated Press. Boy, did that have an impact on the markets, until they managed to retract it and let everyone know that it was a hoax. So it gives you a bit of an insight into maybe the dark side of social media and why we need to be aware of it and why we need, in terms of risk management and working with our organisations, to understand what social media may do. So, as I wrap up, I thought that was a really interesting quote to end on before I go in just sort of and wrap up around the whole digital disruption theme. Because these guys weren't stupid. They're pretty bright guys, run a successful business for a long time, and yet couldn't see the threat. The story I really like in this instance is Kodak. And Kodak's become a bit of a cliche when we talk about digital disruption. And most people now know that Kodak actually invented digital photography. They had the first patent for digital cameras. But the really big issue for Kodak is I'm not sure if they could have seen the change. We heard the term black swan this morning a couple of times. And I think we need to be aware of the black swans. And by definition, you actually can't predict a black swan. That's the definition. Because for Kodak, for decades and centuries, it was all about printing film. Because people wanted to share the Kodak moments. And that was their business. So what really changed the way photos became, the whole entity, the definition, the essence of a photo? It was a black swan, probably two black swans. It was Facebook and the smartphone. Because suddenly a photo wasn't something you shared around the table or had film nights, those of you who remember slide nights. It was something you took thousands of and uploaded to Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat and wherever. So could they really have predicted it? But could they have sensed and adapted and not been as negative or not been as closed-minded as they were? Similarly, that quote from Blockbuster. So I think I hear different things when I talk to the banks and insurance companies about digital disruption. There's a lot of talk about banks are too big, it's regulated, it's capital required heavy, you need trust, you need reputation. You'll never get an Uber or an Airbnb of banking or insurance. Maybe, maybe not. But Kodak said that. Blockbuster said that. Fairfax said that about their rivers of gold, their classified advertisements. So I'm not saying absolutely the banks will be disrupted or the insurance companies will be destroyed by some fintech startup. But it's something we need to be thinking about and advising our clients or our employers. We need to sense. And it may just be around the edges. So peer-to-peer lending and peer-to-peer insurance, using telematics and fitness bands, that all might be around the edges. Or one day it might actually change the whole nature of what we're doing. And so if we just to sort of wrap up a bit, think about the nature of what a disruptor is. A key part of it is the digital platform. Think about Airbnb and Uber and players like that. It's about not just having all the answers themselves. Many of them, if you think about the way they operate, some of the banking startups, they're not replacing the banking system, but they're coming up with a better wallet or a better credit card or a better way of interacting with your banking system. And the learning by experimenting. And that's a critical one. So not just the legacy systems that are going to slow the banks down, but it's the legacy thinking, the insurance companies and the banks. You know, it takes 3 years to put out something or develop something rather than the ability to quickly react. So I'll have to wrap up. Oh, it says there's 6 minutes to go anyway. Disruptors are being disrupted. Aus4x is a foreign exchange website. This is TransferWise is about to launch in Australia and change the business model of even the previous disruptor. And I guess the key that I've been talking about all along, it's about the customer interface. I think those four quotes are really, really telling in that. It's not about owning everything. It's not about doing it all yourselves. But it's about how can you connect and how can you give the customer a really great experience. So thank you. I think we've run out of time for questions, but if you want to ask me questions afterwards, if you want to connect to me on email and Twitter, it's something that I'm really interested in. I'm happy to be told that no, it's never going to happen, or have you seen this great thing that no one's ever heard of? So thanks very much, and enjoy the rest of the conference.